Today is Wednesday. It's July 16th, 2025, and it's 2:40 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast, a podcast for people who care about Chicago. Listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Burry, Executive Director at the Chicago Policy Center and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my Substack, The Last Ward.
Hey, it's Brandon Pilt, multimedia journalist, film and TV critic, and author of the Screening Room Substack newsletter.
Marge Halperin here, award-winning journalist turned commentator and communications consultant and community activist, doing what I can to challenge authority.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago History Substack, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
Almost a full house. I'm Eric Zorn, publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, former Tribune columnist.
Yeah, if John Hansen were able to join us today, we would have had a boat full of people. Last Friday, we were set to record this podcast in front of the St. Genevieve Riverboat in Ottawa. Mincing Rascals listeners, thank you. You bought every last ticket for sale in 2 days. Some of you lined the banks of the river with signs welcoming us. We had listeners that were ready for us to sail by. It was going to be mincing and munching and drinking and the river cruise. And it was possibly going to storm, too. And so 4 hours before we were to record, we were canceled. And I was angry. It'll be fine, I found myself saying. Maybe the same way folks in Texas brushed off the possibility of severe weather there on the 4th of July. So thank you to the sober minds that played it cautiously. We will reschedule for another day. And today, I do want to just talk for a minute about what dominated our conversation last week. Who knew what and when in Texas, and how prepared are we for more inevitable climate-changed severe weather events? You know, one thing that we've learned in the last week, that decades ago, the camp had asked FEMA to remove some of their buildings from the flood map. That would make it easier for them to stay there. And while they knew this was a perilous location, state grants were denied. And locally, no one wanted to pay for a siren system. And lastly, while we said that meteorologists were on duty in the area, other communication experts, hydrologists, and other weather experts were not working that weekend because their positions had been eliminated. They were dozed by the federal government. Trump said only an evil person would ask what went wrong. In the last week, is there anything else that's come to light?
The issues relating directly to Kristi Noem, there are two of them. One is that she had canceled contracts for subcontractors who were handling the emergency phone lines. And their last day was the day of the flood. So on that day, they had, and I don't have it in front of me, but
99%.
99% response. And then their contracts were ended that night. And the next day, it dropped perilously into
the 30s
is what I remember. Yep. So she cut off the phone lines that were literally lifelines to this community. And the second piece is that she set a rule requiring any allocation over $100,000 to come personally to her desk for a sign-off. Any of us who've worked in government or related projects know what a bottleneck that would create, and indeed it did. So she was slow in authorizing a lot of the emergency needs that they had in that area. There was a sharp delay in getting people and supplies out because of her, I would say, lack of administrative ability. $100,000 in an agency like FEMA is not like $100,000 in her state of, now I forgot, North or South Dakota, but Dakota's got a smaller budget. They do, both of them, than this kind of government project. So I don't think she had the managerial expertise or didn't know how to trust those around her who did, or fired all those around her, more likely, who had that expertise. So I love your use of doge as a verb, John, because FEMA has been doged almost out of existence. We can thank, sadly, the victims of this flood for rescuing FEMA. FEMA didn't rescue them, but they rescued FEMA, I believe, because now Trump is saying maybe he'll back off of his plan to get rid of it altogether.
Yeah, Kristi Noem was on Meet the Press this weekend, and she was saying that they were going to just redo or reformulate or reconstruct FEMA, that they were never going to get rid of it, which is not at all what they were saying before, but consistency has never been a hallmark of this administration.
Kate, I didn't appreciate how it sounded when the governor of Texas said that this kind of talk about what went wrong is the talk of losers. And then when Donald Trump turned to a questioner this week who asked about it and said, I don't know who you are, but only an evil person would ask a question like that. When the question was, what do you say to the families and what are we going to do to keep this from happening again? And Trump just said only an evil person would ask that question.
Right. What's worse, evil loser or evil loser? It's just amazing how politicians can flip on a dime. The minute it's the other side that was in charge during a disaster, then you've got to lay blame instantly. I would only say that the governor of Texas was right, only in the sense that we shouldn't have been talking about it right away in terms of who do we finger for this, but in a constructive manner. But this is going to be complicated, and that makes me a little anxious that they will not do a great job of figuring out exactly what went wrong in a way that will be super helpful in the future. Because of the fact that it appears that there was a breakdown at every single level.
Yes.
We can't just say it was DOGE getting rid of a few weather people.
Totally agree.
When actually the weather people did say that they were, in fact, staffed. We can't say it was, just FEMA. But we also can't lay it only on the local people. However, as you pointed out, they could have put it in a siren system. They chose not to. I hadn't even heard the part that you just informed us of, that the camp had asked to have some of their buildings taken off the flood map. But I had heard that there was about an hour in which the camp knew that there was a problem and postponed really evacuating. Maybe this has already turned out to be wrong. But my point is merely that it was an every step of the way problem, and
yeah,
that is going to make it harder for people to really get their heads around and avoid in the future.
One of the firefighters who was on the scene said, hey, we need to issue a code red, but it was an hour before they were able to find the person who had the authority to issue the code red. And the saying I heard this week is was when everybody's at fault, nobody's at fault. And that's kind of where you are here.
Yeah, to your point on accountability, John, I think that speaks to the fact that I think it's very important, and it's tough to talk about this in the immediate aftermath of a specific tragedy. But this is why state and local government is way, way, way better equipped to be responsive and accountable for disasters like this than the federal government is. And you can talk to anyone who is involved with FEMA's response to Hurricane Katrina or really any other disaster to talk about how slow and disorganized FEMA is all the time. And whereas at the state level, if this is really something that is prioritized by state leaders, the governor is held accountable, and there are changes that are made as a result of that. And if you think back in Florida, which today is one of the best states at disaster preparedness, came really in the aftermath of, I believe it was Lawton Childs, who was the Democratic governor of Florida during Hurricane Andrew. And there was a bad federal response, but there's a bad state response. And he really was held accountable for that, but then put in place a lot of the metrics and infrastructure that you see today that makes Florida so resilient to these kinds of things and really a national leader, regardless of who's governor. So I would just want to emphasize that state and local flexibility, knowledge, speed is really important.
But they don't have the dollars, Austin.
They do not rely on the federal government.
But the federal government has the dollars.
They can supercharge things, but in terms of boots on the ground or even infrastructure for directing resources,
yeah,
it's just going to be so much better at the state and local level. And really, from a fairness perspective, state and local taxpayers should be the ones footing the bill for that, not necessarily federal folks. If people are in the Great Plains, they will have certain costs for their local state, local and state services. Taxpayers in Florida and Texas should be paying a premium, which they already are in their insurances and in their taxes, to pay for the response to these kinds of things.
It would be a good idea to get rid of FEMA, Austin?
There should be some sort of federal, probably baseline standards that state and local governments have to meet, and that can be monitored by a federal agency. But I think the less that it is involved in the immediate aftermath, provision of any services beyond funding, the better outcomes will be. And well, the more resilient these places will be to disasters.
Think of Kristi Noem having her finger on the checkbook, $100,000. No, you don't have the money. You don't have the money because some federal bureaucrat wasn't on the ball.
Overall, I just think it's incredibly tragic. I think it is important to ask questions and hold those in power accountable as to what did they know, what could have been done. I think it's also important to take a look at the demographics of the area, the voting patterns of the area, and see what exactly, what decisions laid at the hands of the voters, and what did they decide, and how did we get to the point we did. But also, my hearts are just with the victims. Still so many missing out there, more than 130 dead. We have some Illinois teams, Chicago teams as well, heading out to help with the relief. I tend to agree that the day after, as it happened, was a little too soon. We do find a way to always kind of go right to the politics of it all in a time where I don't think the politics should matter. However, now I think is the time to start asking those questions and figuring out. And this question around FEMA, I think it's very fair to interrogate the federal government when it comes to eliminating FEMA, as they said they wanted to do when they ran, or scaling it back, because not every state is going to be able to handle the removal of federal assistance. There's got to be a plan in place before you start talking about cutting things. And I think that speaks to the major criticism often of the Trump administration and the overall Trump strategy. It's a lot of get rid of this, cut that, but not a lot of thought to what happens after you do so.
Well, remember one of the ideas was just cut every 10th federal employee, and then randomly you lose a hydrologist and a communications expert in Texas, and it's like, well, that's thinning the government. Oh, no, wait, we needed those guys. We needed those people in those positions. But clearly, Austin, you are an evil person even for bringing this up.
I'm trying to make these people less vulnerable to the whims of Washington, D.C., and, you know, who decides when to cut what contract, you know? Like, they're not going to be able to hold the president accountable in those states, but it's the different story when it's your state government.
Or your county board.
The funding issue, though, does make them vulnerable. There's a story that just came out as we were coming on the air that a coalition of 20 states have sued the Trump administration today over cutting down billions of dollars in FEMA grants aimed at protecting communities from floods, hurricanes, national disasters. So this lawsuit is targeting cuts in the very kind of funding that we're talking about here that's critical to states. I think you're right, John. The states do not have this money, though I'm not necessarily opposed to Austin's idea that they have the expertise on the ground, but they need the money.
I have a question about that. Do the when you have the boots on the ground issue is certainly critical. When you have a situation like you have in Texas, you need people to come in, and you may not have the volunteers ready to address that problem. Is that isn't the Army Corps of Engineers or someone else responsible for preventing disasters? That FEMA comes in after disasters occur. I didn't think FEMA was. I could be wrong. I don't really know that much about the structure, but it does seem to me like there should be significant federal dollars going toward disaster preparedness, but that actually responding to disasters belongs to a whole separate entity. But maybe I don't understand that very well.
Oh, I think you're right. I think they were the ones who stepped in on the revetment project here on our own lakeshore some 15, 20 years ago when a lot of the lakefront was revetted, if that's
revetted.
The Army Corps of Engineers was the partner for that, right, and funded it and did the work, I believe. So, I don't know what Trump is doing about that, but I'd be surprised if they're giving them more money.
Well, I don't want to derail this conversation too much, but it seems to me like this is part of the conversation about State Farm's intention to raise home insurance rates dramatically in Illinois, saying that because of the, hailstorms or tornadoes that we were seeing, that their costs have gone through the roof. And this is not related to problems they have in Florida and Texas and Louisiana and places like that. But there is this question as to when you live in a certain part of the world or part of the country, should you bear responsibility for everyone in your state or for everyone in the country? You know, Austin floated the idea earlier that, well, people who live in Florida are taking the risk of living in Florida because it's hurricane country, and we're in Illinois and it's not hurricane country, so shouldn't they pay more? Which makes sense to me.
I think insurance markets are really, really important for making your system less vulnerable to risky events. So, for example, you know, in the state of Florida, it's a really big issue right now. Like, everybody talks about, oh man, Illinois property taxes are way too high, which they are. Look at, I can go to Florida, but it's like, okay, well, what are you paying in home insurance in Florida? And it's oftentimes even more than your property tax bill would be in Illinois. And that's good. That's a signal that says, hey, it's really risky to live here. You have to pay this big premium to live here because, you know, if we're going to pay, we have a high likelihood of having to pay you out. And I think when we talk about climate change, an important part of being resilient to climate change is letting those markets work. Make it really, really expensive to build, you know, right next to an area where the sea level is rising, or else you're going to have to, there's going to be a crisis event where the federal government's going to get a lot of pressure to come in and just bail people out who had made on their own, by their own choice, a very risky decision that they didn't really have to pay the actual cost of. So I think it's very important to have these local signals of risky behavior for everybody's benefit.
Well, isn't this what happened in California, which was that they set some state limits on insurance, and so people could build more easily in these fire-prone areas, and so that in effect, I mean, I'm sort of making Austin's point again, which is that if you keep insurance costs artificially low and you spread them out over the entire population, you are allowing people to become more vulnerable to disasters.
Exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right, the same situation.
We're not sure if State Farm is raising its rates quite so exponentially on us for what's really happening here in Illinois, or in order to even out their risk across all these other places, right? So that's what it sounds like to me, that possibly part of our increase is paying for the increase in extreme weather events like tornadoes, et cetera, taking place even more in other places. I think that's kind of the heart of the issue in terms of State Farm raising our rates here in Illinois.
They've denied that, by the way.
Yeah, they deny that. But that's what it feels like.
They can deny that all they want. I'm sure it's true.
I was going to ask who buys that, but I mean, I'd like to believe these companies when they talk to us at that level.
We in Chicago, for instance, and I get that they cannot, you know, whittle this down perhaps to zip codes, but should I in Chicago be paying for the risk of someone who lives literally in Tornado Alley in downstate Illinois?
Or who lives in the floodplains by the river, right?
I mean, yeah. I get they're going to charge me more on my car insurance for living in Chicago, where my catalytic converter is probably going to get ripped off and my windows are probably going to get smashed. But I'm not living next to a river where I'm going to get flooded, and no tornado has ever come anywhere near me. I'm just saying it's not fair for me to pay those aspects.
From a commercial standpoint, I believe in local responsibility in the way you're all sort of leaning, but I don't want that to get overshadowed. I don't want that to overshadow this question of shared responsibility through government. I believe that our federal and state and local government has an obligation to all of our neighbors, and that we as residents of each of these communities also share in that obligation to help people in need. Our government no longer is very concerned about helping the neediest among us, the most underserved. They're now, you know, trying to slash DEI programs so that people who have been underrepresented and underserved in all kinds of areas no longer get an extra jolt of equality, let's say. But I think when it comes to where our money and our tax dollars go, I want them to go to support people who need it. I don't want to encourage people to keep moving back and spending more of their life savings in areas that are not really long-term going to support inhabitants. I think that cycle is foolish, whether it's rich people in California fire zones or poor people in the lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. I just think some of these areas because of climate change, which we also don't recognize as a country as an issue, but because of that, we're going to have climate refugees from around our country and around the world. And I believe we are citizens of communities. We are not private residents worried about our own four walls.
I think the problem is that politically, though, every time something happens where people should not rebuild in a particular place, it's too politically difficult, and we just pay for them to rebuild there anyway.
Yeah. Well, it looks bad. The optics of that are bad.
I assume we're going to start getting climate refugees, but right now the problem is still the constant rebuilding of things in places where they shouldn't be, instead of those people coming here to live with us.
Well, going back to this idea, I don't want to take over this conversation too much, but that it does seem to me that if State Farm raises its rates, there's Allstate and other and AAA and other insurers, and if they don't raise their rates, then the market, isn't the market going to decide what good homeowner insurance rates are going to be in Illinois? I mean, if this were like a government mandate, like you got to buy from State Farm, but you don't. And this is why, this is something that I haven't seen in other in the stories about this, which is, okay, well, what are the other insurers doing here that we're all on fire about State Farm, but okay, so State Farm raises its prices. Well, what if Amazon raises its prices and people will go to Walmart, right? Isn't that kind of the idea behind market capitalism?
I know you're right, but it's so hard to change your insurance.
I know. I don't even want to look.
There's another model, though. I am a longtime customer of Amica Insurance that is on a shareholder basis. So at the end of the year, if business goes well, we all get a check. And I've gotten a check every year for, I don't know, 20 years, however long I've been their customer, and they don't follow those rate hikes. There are insurance companies out there that are not State Farm and Allstate, which we think of as the whole industry. But you're exactly right, Eric, and I think there are other models, and those are very successful, too. And John, maybe you ought to look around a little.
I'm writing this down. A-M-I-C-A.
Amica. Can you spell that for me, Marge? How do you spell that?
It's my A-M-I-C-A, for which I get, well, I could say I don't get a check, but I just said I do. So,
all right. But, so you're a paid spokesperson, are you? Okay.
No.
She's the equivalent.
Shareholder.
She's the Geico lizard for Amica. Here is a version of our attraction distraction game, the Jeffrey Epstein file. The former financier and convicted sex offender may have had a list of individuals who accompanied him on weekend getaways or parties. And while the MAGA world wanted to see that list, the Department of Justice has not released a full report with the names. Well, the president is done talking about it, but not done talking about not talking about it. The MAGA world wants more. Even Mike Johnson seems to have said that more information should be forthcoming. He's sort of walking that back a little bit, but he can't walk it back completely. And peripheral characters like Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon want more. Does this issue matter?
Doesn't matter. I mean, if Donald Trump is on Epstein's client list,
yeah, matters. What does that mean?
Maybe, actually, I say that, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe his
doesn't mean he committed a crime. Does and he can't go to jail. So what's the point?
Well, it doesn't mean that he committed a crime. It might mean that he might have committed a crime that's outside the reach of the statute of limitations. But it's certainly grotesque behavior. On the other hand, nothing that he does seems to shake his supporters. But what this gets at is MAGA's belief. And it's something that Trump has inflamed all along, that the deep state runs everything, that there's this cabal that basically includes the Clintons and Obamas and the pedophile ring and all this other. I mean, this wild conspiracy theories that Trump has dined out on for years, and it's just come back to bite him, where all of a sudden, you know, he's gotten everybody excited about the Epstein files and talking about that kind of conspiracy. And then suddenly, when it looks like it might get a little close to home, it's like, oh, there's no files. And if there are files, they were made by the Clintons and Obamas and the Bidens and not me. And it's incoherent. And you are hearing some of his supporters saying enough, that they want more from this. They want to hear about this. And so is it important on its own? Arguably, I think it is. But why it's politically important is that it seems to be fragmenting this the MAGA coalition. There seems to be some percentage of them that really want to hear more.
Well, don't they realize whose name might be on that list? Everybody's chomping at the bit, maybe because they want to see if Donald Trump's name is on there. Well, that doesn't help the MAGA coalition. So I'm wondering what their motivation is, too. Not that there's a MAGA spokesperson other than Donald Trump, but I mean, what's the end game here? And is the only reason that we're interested in it at all is because Donald Trump's name may be on that list? But if so, what is the list? What does that mean? That doesn't convict you of anything. It means there's a list and your name is on it. So I'm hard-pressed to see the motivation behind this inquiry other than the purient interest of who's on there and also what the fallout would be. How does it matter?
I'm tempted to say to Trump, you know, karma's a baby. He's fostered his own conspiracy theory, and it is hurting him. But to your question, John, I don't think the idea is not that it would just be a client list, but it would also list the client's predilections. So they want to know who was going after young underage girls, because it's part of this whole QAnon theory about Democrats and corporate leaders being a part of a pedophilia ring. You know, that's the unstoppable QAnon rumor. And that's what's fueling this. If Trump, do they know Trump is friends, was friends with Epstein? They know he likes pretty young girls. I don't think they care about that. But they think this list is going to expose corporate leaders. I could take your question and add another phrase to it. And don't they know those corporate leaders are now all part of the MAGA camp, the way they're all capitulating to his demands and supporting his cryptocurrency and doing all the things he wants? You know, they don't have the information we have because they're not watching and reading the news that we read. But the latest thing I saw is, if I say it right, Ghislaine Maxwell, who was, the wing woman for Epstein, grooming all the young girls that came into the program that he was running. Well, she's in jail, and it would appear that she is waiting for a pardon from Trump. I read someone's speculation to that effect.
Speculation.
But now he can't pardon her, because then he's part of the conspiracy. Now that he really has revved up MAGA about it, she's stuck in jail with no way out. They're talking about subpoenaing her to Congress to testify. Maybe she's ready to sing.
Or maybe she's ready to say all kinds of nice things about Donald Trump, because that's how people get pardons and commutations.
Yeah, but the political reality seems to not be in her favor, at least not right now. She's going to have to cool for quite a while before it would be safe for him to do it, based on his own MAGA supporters' response to all of this.
I just don't see it mattering to his supporters. And yeah, I mean, they're upset about this case, but If she refuses to testify and then 2 months later he gives her a pardon, because his story now is this is all phony, it's all ginned up, it's all nonsense,
hoax.
So it would be logical in his mind to say, well, this poor woman is in prison for nothing, I'm letting her out. I mean, what a Blagojevich. He didn't understand Blagojevich.
He doesn't say the pedophilia aspect of what Epstein was doing is wrong. He says the list is a fabrication, but he has never said Epstein was not guilty in the pedophilia. And I don't think he can say that to that QAnon MAGA base that he has, because they're too far gone.
We all know Trump literally ran on conspiracies like this, right? Mm-hmm. And now he's telling everyone he's calling it the Epstein hoax. And he's saying it's Biden's fault and it's Hillary's fault.
All these
revisionist history. As a politician, when you subscribe to conspiracy theories, and not that I have experience with it, but it's probably like taking cocaine. It gives you an exhilarating high, but it's killing your body on the inside. And that's what we're seeing happening right now. MAGA world is turning on Donald Trump. Some of the more prominent influencers started turning, and now, because they got a call from up top, they're trying to change tune. But the people on the ground, the people that voted for Trump in droves, they're not buying it. And now it's like bizarre world all of a sudden. You got Democratic politicians now calling for the release of the Epstein list, if there is an Epstein list, and playing into this conspiracy. It's a fascinating case study of what's happened in our online social media driven political environment. And I'm very curious if this is really going to be the thing that becomes an Achilles heel for Trump, a victim of his own circumstance, in a sense. It's almost poetic when you think of it. But the whole question of an Epstein list, that's the big thing. I would like to know, is there one? It's hard for me to fathom that this major billionaire kept a running list of every single person he interacted with. It's not something you see a lot in criminal cases. If there is not an Epstein list, why are there efforts to block such a list? It's a conspiracy theory that just keeps on giving and gives fuel now to Democrats. So how they message this going forward, I'm looking at my timeline. Ted Lieu, Dan Goldman, all these prominent Dems, Ro Khanna, are now banging the drum, release the Epstein files, and folks like Nancy Mace.
Marjorie Taylor Greene wants it released.
Marjorie Taylor Greene wants it released, but people like Nancy Mace are getting in trouble now and getting the community noted writ large. Elon Musk is coming out, and you know, he's full of energy. So,
see, you're enjoying this too much, Brandon. This is my point.
I don't know if I'm enjoying it. I just think it's fascinating.
Well, but I mean, so but nobody has said to me, and therefore this will happen. Like an agency will close, or tax dollars will shift, or this is all the stuff of People Magazine. This is not something that matters.
Well, we got a People Magazine president. So.
And what if it matters at the midterms? What if they turn?
Okay,
from
now
him?
Now we're going somewhere.
Meanwhile, Lauren Boebert has suggested Matt Gaetz as special counsel to investigate. That's rich.
Well, he's.
I do think it has potential effects in the midterm because it is the litmus test issue for, are you the person who's going to take on the deep state? Are you the person who is with the populace? Are you with the elites? Is what, you know, this is a lagging indicator of where you stand on that issue. And what's interesting is if you see Trump in interviews about this, you know, during the campaign, he was not as much of a firebrand on this issue. Like he said, you know, we'll look into it and, you know, there might be something there. You know, he's like kind of dancing around it a little bit. It's more his surrogate, the Cash Patels of the world, the Dan Bonginos, these people made it their whole brand. And now they're sitting in the seat, in the halls of power, and they look completely ridiculous to their base because this was the one thing that they were going to go in there and do that Biden was never going to do. So I do think there's some legitimacy to the idea that, hey, we deserve to know more about why he got such a sweet plea deal. And was he potentially a friend or an asset to other things that the government was doing? Do we know the entire scope of that? What else could be out there about that? Those are the types of questions that, you know, foment in this conspiratorial sort of idea, which doesn't mean it's not true, but those sorts of ideas foment.
Yeah.
And if you're Trump, just what you should do or what Bondi should do is go out, do a 6-hour press conference, get every last question out of the way, stand there and say yes or no to these things. And the biggest problem was the way with their base is the way in which this was rolled out, which was a sloppily, hastily done sort of, there's not a list. Like even just the words that they were kind of using was just so needlessly, you know, it seems like it was thought about for like 2 seconds and then a statement was released when this is a really core issue to like a lot of their constituency.
Well, let me ask you this, Austin. Do you think that the president's lack of endorsement of all of this looks suspicious?
It's hard for me to know why specifically Trump acts this way on this issue, because it very much could be, given his pattern of other behavior, Bondi is my person, she says this, so anyone who's against that, I'm just going, you're an idiot, this is nothing, this is all Clinton stuff. Like, I think I'm more in your camp, John, of like, there could be, yeah, you could go look in Jeffrey Epstein's cell phone and there's a list of like, he was a huge financier. There's going to be tons of powerful people in his phone. What does that actually mean? Like, what other information associated with that? I think it's a stretch given what we know to say like, oh, there's a piece of paper with Trump written on it and like all of his preferences for women or something like that. Like, I doubt that that's in there, but I do think there could be things like, you know, what kinds of deals was Jeffrey Epstein doing with who and for what purpose on the financial side that may have been an important element of U.S. government or foreign government activities. That's possible. That's completely possible, given his background.
Well, Trump is loyal to a point. He'll be loyal right up until the point he throws someone under the bus, right? So at the moment, he'd rather look like he's hired the best and smartest people, and that's why he's trying not to let her go and didn't want Walz to totally go, and now is appointing him to the UN and after Signalgate and all that. So he likes to look like he made the right appointments. Right. But if it really is harming to him, dangerous to him, she'll be out. I have no doubt.
Talking about Pam
the
Bob.
Point on the litmus test that I think mm-hmm. the correct comparison is like the anger with which the Republican base, the anger directed towards the entire media and political apparatus saying, telling us Joe Biden's fine, but he's not fine. And we can all see it was the same thing with Epstein. Clearly, there's something messed up here. This guy didn't kill himself and the Biden people won't say it. And that was it wasn't as much furor and, you know, broad awareness as the Biden thing. But I would say that is right in line with there as like a litmus test kind of thing. So I don't think it will go away.
Very good comparison. That's what's driving the MAGA base really crazy is that they are positive something's there. And it's the kind of scandal where none of us really believe there is a true client list that has Donald Trump up there at number one or whatever. But there are enough things about this particular case that even someone who's not inclined to believe there's anything going on has to go, oh, wait, what a minute? Wait a minute, what? There's 3 minutes missing out of that tape? How come the camera in his cell wasn't working? I mean, there's a lot of just weird details that don't add up. It's easy to see why truly crazy people are going to be out of their minds about this. What's almost scariest about this whole thing is that the Trump administration is not even capable of doing a coordinated response in any way, shape, or form. It's like none of them has ever worked with a PR company of any kind. If you're going to come out and say, We've been spewing this to you throughout the campaign. We thought it was a big thing and it's nothing. If that's what you're going to do, they should have come out with an actual report. Why the missing time in the video is not a problem, et cetera. Instead of Pam Bondi just kind of stumbling over her words, trying to explain why it's okay for this minute to be missing.
Going forward is
going to be that it is a gigantic split in the MAGA base that is not being healed. It's interesting to see the difference in response compared to, say, Donald Trump deciding to bomb Iran when perhaps that was one of his biggest issues was that he was never going to get us into another war. He was never going to do something like that. And then he goes and bombs Iran. And I'm sure we all remember a lot of MAGA people were out of their minds about that too, but it simmered down very, very quickly. Not this. This is going no place. It's going to stay there.
Yeah, I'd like to just hit briefly on what Austin said about the Biden auto pen theories, which is that I think it's very curious that Jill Biden took the Fifth Amendment and that Trump's physician took the Fifth Amendment when they were called to testify in front of Congress. I believe
that Biden's physician.
Biden's.
But you meant
Biden's
Biden,
physician no. and his wife both took the Fifth Amendment when called to testify in Congress about whether Biden, used the auto pen on things. The auto pen was used on things that he had no knowledge of. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that you take the Fifth Amendment when to avoid prosecution. You can't incriminate yourself. So the obvious inference from at least a lay perspective is what is it that Jill Biden thinks would incriminate her or that the doctor thinks would incriminate her? Now, they didn't cite spousal privilege or doctor-client
privilege,
patient confidentiality. They took the Fifth Amendment. And I that raises suspicions in my mind. I don't think there's anything they should do about it necessarily, but it does make me raise my eyebrows quite a bit.
I had the same thought. The doctor has client patient privilege, doctor patient privilege rights. He could have named those. I think that's what I was screaming at the TV when I heard that.
Is anybody screaming at the TV about stuff happening in Chicago in the last week since we recorded our most recent episode of the Mincing Rascals podcast? Snap curfews have come up. Granny flats were an issue in the city council, but they didn't take it up this week.
The housing fight was really interesting. Brandon Johnson kind of put a chip out and said, hey, I want to be able to legalize, it's called by right. So basically, if you know there's a two or three flat, everybody in every ward should be able to make an accessory dwelling unit, also called a granny flat, like in their backyard, and be able to rent that out. That really puts a target on aldermanic privilege. Aldermen don't like the idea of residents just being able to build more, because then other people on their block come to their office and, you know, complain, you know, we got rental families or something on this block in the bungalow belt that we didn't want here. So that was really politically difficult, and it didn't come up for vote today. It was deferred and published. So that will likely come up again in September. However, another very good pro-housing reform did pass today, and that is the an ordinance that removed basically parking mandates for new construction near public transit. And that is one of the best, you know, quote unquote, free policy levers that you can pull in the city of Chicago to spur more development. It's so expensive to require new parking for, say, if you're building, you know, a 10, 20 story building near a CTA station, the people there don't really aren't using a personal vehicle a lot. But, oh, this red tape says that we have to have this many parking spaces. So that means you got to build a parking garage underneath, and that explodes the cost of the project, basically. So that passing is great for the city of Chicago. But unfortunately, granny flats have to wait.
I live across the street from NEMA, the 70 some story tower at the south foot of the gateway to the South Loop, they called it. It's got 14 stories of parking. And when they built that, I just thought, how short-sighted. We're a block and a half from a CTA station that has four of the five or six lines, CTA lines. We're right on Michigan Avenue with all the buses that take you anywhere in the city that you want to go. 14 stories of cars seems like a waste of space and not forward-thinking. And not good for the neighborhood. It's a lot of cars we don't need in this neighborhood for just ease of traffic on Roosevelt Road. So I'm with you on this one.
Yeah, but how safe do the people in the neighborhood feel walking the sidewalk in the evening or taking public transportation? I don't know, Marge, but it would seem to me like...
Yeah, I walked home from an event last night at about 9:30. Michigan Avenue is a safe place to be.
I will not argue that point with you, but if I was building a building and I wanted to get people to move into the building, it would seem to me like, the cost notwithstanding, having parking on site would be an attractive selling point too, right?
But it just was so much. I just feel like it's a rental building. I think rental people are more transient and more mobile.
Yeah.
And I just think for that building, it was more than they need and more than we need in the neighborhood.
Is there any chance that Mike Madigan is going to get a delay? He's supposed to go in October, but he wants to appeal. And one of the stories I saw in the Tribune or Sun-Times said that could delay his actually going to jail by months or even years. I don't know that we need to talk a lot about poor old Mike Madigan, although 7 years will be a long time if he goes to jail for that long. If you're young enough, you might want to just go to jail and get it over with. If I were him, I might want to delay it as much as possible because you might never get out.
I can just say is it possible? Yes, it happened with George Ryan. He was able to, didn't have to report to prison because of his appeals until 14 months after he was sentenced. And it was 11, he delayed going into prison by 11 months. He was supposed to go in January of 2007, and he didn't have to report because of his appeals until November of 2007. So that worked for him. I can't begin to referee the validity of his appellate claims, but yeah, it's certainly possible that they will just let him stay out of prison. You know, I would think that anybody sentenced to a crime like that would want to get it over with, because if he's 83 now, what, he'll be 84, 85 going in. That's, you know, you're taking about a significant percentage of your life that's going to be taken away, and it's just hanging over your head for the next 2 years. Might as well get it over with. That's what I would think. And we'll see when I commit a heinous white collar crime later in life if I still hold to that.
Yeah, I wonder if you can enjoy your time out. Just before Ed Burke went to jail, I saw him at a restaurant with another couple, he and his wife, and they seemed to be having a good time. And it was that period of time between when he had been sentenced and he went to jail. And I thought, I don't know how you're enjoying this dinner. If it was only going to be 2 years, or in his case, 10 months, 9, 10 months, what did you say, Eric? 9 months and 16 days? I think I would just assume get the clock running on that.
In his case, it is a long enough sentence that I would predict that he's going to drag his feet as long as possible, instead of like Alderman Burke did not. Alderman Burke pretty much went in right away and got it done with. The thinking will be, the older I am when it actually comes back around to me, the more likely I can just beg off, because now I'm really too old to go to prison, sort of thing.
Oh, that's right. They do have that consideration that if you're old enough, they're going to, I don't know what the formula is for that, but Ed Burke got out early, yeah, not just because exactly. of good behavior, but because he was old.
He could either beg off, oh, look how my health has deteriorated, so now I shouldn't go to prison at all, or now he's old enough that once he gets in, he gets off practically, you know, as quickly as Ed Burke did.
Is there some calculation that automatically is plugged in that says if you're 82 and you're sentenced for 2 years and you behave well, then we multiply it by 0.06 and you get those days off as well?
What I've seen is that it's up to the judge. It establishes the option to have, they call it compassionate release for elderly inmates. There may be, they call it extraordinary and compelling reasons, including age and medical condition, and the judge considers the circumstances when making a decision, but it's not cut and dried the way you're suggesting. And in fact, one thing I saw suggested they're supposed to pay serve a significant portion of their sentence, at least 75% of the term, which is not what Ed Burke did, but apparently, and or have clout in the court system, which apparently he did.
Burke had such a laundry list of well-wishers, though. I'm sure that weighed on. Well, the judge said as much, that mattered to her when she was doing the sentencing, too.
But even that seems so unfair. You think of somebody who comes from a gang background, family, and they try to get ahead or they don't, and they end up in prison for some youthful felony. I mean, something done in their youth that put them in jail or not, and they get old in jail too, and they don't know the rich and famous people that Ed Burke knows. So I don't know why that was a condition. That always made me uncomfortable.
Hmm.
They shouldn't even have those personal letters, and
right.
as far as I'm concerned.
Speaking of local stories, I just wanted to ask Austin about this pension thing that's going on right now and the cost that it might impose on the city.
In the waning days of legislative session in Springfield, there was a provision that was snuck through by State Senator Robert Martwick in Chicago that is a pension sweetener for police and fire in the city of Chicago. And it essentially applies to tier two folks, so people hired after 2011. And his argument is, well, police and fire in other parts of the state get this sweetener, so Chicago needs to get it too. The problem with this is that Chicago police and fire pension funds are the worst funded pension systems in the country. Chicago has the worst debt problem of any big city in the country, the worst pension problem of any big city in the country. And these sweeteners add $11 billion with a B dollars to Chicago's pension debt. And it's an unfunded mandate. There's no ability to pay for this. So on one hand, you have, you know, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, the Chicago Teachers Union, the transit advocates all saying, Springfield, Springfield, give us more money. We need more money. We need more money. And then Springfield is going and saying, no, we are passing this unfunded mandate that will cost next year $60 million out of the budget. We'll go straight to this. It's just a pension sweetener, $60 million that could be spent on other things. And at the end of this ramp, it's a $750 million line item just for this one thing. This is fiscally insane. It passed in true Illinois fashion unanimously and quickly in the General Assembly. No one knew, had any idea what it cost when it passed. Now there's an actuarial analysis out on it. Every alderman should be speaking out against this, who once is calling for more money. The mayor needs to be speaking out against this. And J.B. Pritzker has an amazing opportunity here. I think this is like a Rubicon moment for him to be the adult in the room and say, hey guys, I know this didn't really pass with appropriate scrutiny, please go and look at this issue again. He has until August 24th, I think, might be 23rd, to veto this. If he does nothing, it will pass into law, or he could sign it into law. So we have this week, Susana Mendoza, the comptroller, saying that she will not run again for the Illinois comptroller. Her entire campaign is really going to be around fiscal responsibility. She's largely expected to run for mayor. I think this would be a great issue for her to speak up on and for her to really own and say, hey, the mayor of the city of Chicago needs to speak up about this right now if you care about the fiscal future of the city.
What would it provide for the officers themselves if they got this additional pension?
It's basically, it changes the cap of your pensionable salary. You can apply more. You get a bigger pension based on your salary.
Right.
I think maybe a little bit on retirement age it changes, but it essentially just makes these pensions more lucrative and more expensive.
Well, isn't it past time to talk about the equivalent of a congressional budget office for the state legislature, an independent nonpartisan group who would evaluate bills, and votes couldn't happen until we had the numbers from an agency like that? You can discredit the number, which is what Republicans have done on their big, brutal bill, but the number is out there for others to, and voters especially, to see before they vote. I think you've talked about this, Austin, am I right?
Well, at the city level, we definitely need that. At the state level, they do have an office staff that can do that. But lawmakers have to basically request it. And it's not like the bill stops if you don't have it. Mm. So people can request what's called, a fiscal note on any piece of legislation. And that has to be provided. But this is just part of the culture where it's a pay later political culture. And because the way our Constitution is set up, if you give this away now, it can never be changed under the Constitution. So to shackle people in Chicago for the next 30 years with this snap decision from Robert Martwick and some unions who want this is just so unjust and so irresponsible. It's shocking that no one brought it up during the legislative session. And it would be a really horrible thing. If it
about Mendoza,
now, how
though?
Do we think Governor Pritzker is going to look at this in terms of, I think it does not behoove him in terms of his presidential ambitions to not veto this crazy additional pension, because he's already going to have a little bit of a tough road to hoe defending Illinois' economic climate on a national stage. He's already going to have that. His gubernatorial ambitions, his reelection campaign, he probably wants the firemen and the policemen and everyone else who bought into this. So it'll be very interesting to see which direction he takes.
Well, it'll also be interesting to see which direction Susana Mendoza takes, because one of her calling cards is that she is very pro-police of the candidates who are on the Democratic side. That's one of her her branding issues, which is, I think her brother was a police officer or is a police officer.
Yeah.
She's runs a little bit as a law and order type and with a friend of those unions. So I wonder what position she will take if she runs for mayor on this, because Austin's right. She has, you have these two kind of conflicting brands. You've got the fiscal responsibility brand, which she has been harping on as controller. And then you've got the her pro-police stance. So it's going to be interesting to see where that goes.
The most important thing we can talk about today, of course, is the Major League Baseball All-Star Game and the way they ended it for the first time ever in a home run hitting competition. The score was tied after 9 innings, and rather than go extra innings and expend those valuable arms for the pitchers, they allowed each side to take 3 batters, and they get 3 pitches to hit, or 3 swings, and they see who can hit the most home runs. And lo and behold, Kyle Schwarber saved the day for the National League, hit home runs in all of his swings. National League wins the All-Star Game. I wondered, our news click at WGNRadio.com, our daily web poll question is, should Major League Baseball institute that during the regular season? They already put a ghost runner on second in the 10th inning. How about in the 11th or 12th, say, okay, we're done. We're just going to have a home run hitting contest. 10 pitches or 5 pitches or 9 pitches, whatever. Who liked that game and who likes that idea? Eric, did you watch the All-Star game?
I didn't watch it, but I don't like the idea. And the reason is that I think it would skew the roster makeup of teams. If they knew this was going to happen, they would end up putting more like sluggers on their roster and fewer defensive players. It would just change the way that whole teams are constructed, which I don't care for. I do like the idea of ghost runners. Maybe add a ghost runner every extra inning until you start with bases loaded, or give them 4 outs or something like that. Something that doesn't change the way the game is actually played. So I vote no.
Well, that's changing the way the game is played, by the way. But okay, everything is up for consideration here.
I did not watch the game. I haven't watched a Major League Baseball All-Star game in a while. Partially because I find watching baseball on TV to be extremely boring until the last 7, 8, 9 innings. However, I saw all the great highlights. One, hated the uniforms. Lowercase ALNL.
But in the game itself, they wore their team jerseys.
Which I also hate, because I think you should have all-star
jerseys. Oh, wow. You and I can't be friends anymore then.
I think you have to have all-star jerseys. I think
No, you want to see the team that the guy plays for. You want to see the Cubs jersey on TV, no?
I mean, put a logo on it, right?
Got it?
You could
okay.
do it. Yeah, but I think it's cool to have like the separate all-star game editions of these jerseys, especially just like as a fan to wear out and say, hey, 20 years from now, remember that crazy all-star game in 2025? Here's my commemorative, you know, jersey to represent that. Overall, though, I think any efforts to try to make the game better should be welcomed. I know that baseball is one of those sports where the old guard is very resistant to change, but I think bring it on, because as we've seen, the pitch clock, one of those things that people really
railed
against.
That's been good
for
the game.
Improved the game.
Yeah.
It's been awesome.
Savannah Bananas have proven that you can make baseball really, really entertaining if you want to. And it's always, I think you should apply all the Savannah Bananas ideas to the All-Star game as like a lab for stuff.
They about did.
And I thought that was really cool. I would also shout out the ceremony they did about Hank Aaron breaking the home run record is one of the coolest things I've seen in a baseball. Did you see that, John? Where they
yeah.
had this whole, it was projected onto the field and they had like a firework that shot the ball up. It was so cool. And it really brought that moment to life in like this digital way where it was actually projected on the field. So yeah, more stuff like that. And baseball's getting better. Baseball used to really suck at stuff like this, especially social media. And that was NBA just like ate so much of its viewership because it was much more friendly to like online creators and making content. And MLB is like getting a little better.
No, that was a nice big show. That was the best TV baseball's put on in a long time. I think they are realizing that the NFL figured out how to do a Super Bowl, and so they're going to go ahead and put on a show. There was a hip-hop concert as part of the introduction of the players with dancers. I mean, that Hank Aaron thing went for a few minutes, and then they went to a commercial break, and then they just ginned the thing back up and kept going. And they were talking to the players while they were in the field playing the game, literally talking to a pitcher as he's winding up, going, what are you going to throw here? He goes, here comes a slider. You wouldn't institute that in the regular season. What Pete Crow Armstrong said was absolutely touching.
For the kids that want to be like you, what would you tell them?
I hope you be exactly how you are supposed to be. You know, I think I've dealt with, you know, trying to emulate other people and focusing a little bit less on myself and what makes me great and unique. And I think that is so important for kids that play this game or don't. Just understand that, you know, there's so much to offer, and everybody's so nice and unique in their own individual way.
Pete, you are a gift to this game. You don't change, okay?
Thank you, guys. Nice talking to you.
I was just going to say about the Savannah Bananas. You know, they sold out Rate Field, whatever it's called now. They sold out 2 games next month. We wanted to go. We couldn't get tickets, so we may have to go.
I have standing room only tickets, and I'm glad to have them.
ESPN2. Is
very,
the way I'll
very,
say.
They're a phenomenon. They're a real phenomenon. It's really fun to see.
And it was also funny about the game was that who do you want to see doing the home run hitting at the end of the game to determine who wins the game? You want to see Aaron Judge. You want to see Shohei Ohtani. Well, they had already played in the game. They had been taken out. Now somebody else was subbed in for them. They had showered and were on their way to their planes. They weren't even in the ballpark when they actually said, okay, we're going to do the swing off. Aaron Judge, he's not here now. He's gone. Ohtani was gone too. So God bless Kyle Schwarber. He was still in the building.
But maybe you could allay my objection to this by saying that the player who hits in the home run derby at the end of the game has to have played at least 4 innings during the game itself, so that you can't just like have like 3 beefy guys who hit home runs who are sitting on your bench waiting for extra innings.
Some Southside guys that play softball.
Those guys. Softball guys who can really
just jack it.
What you're saying about the big hitters having left the stadium because they didn't expect the home run derby just reminds me, it's kind of like what happened with Mark Burley. game three of that series. It went 14 innings. It was at the time the longest World Series game there ever was. And he had been the starter for the previous game. So this was like, I think, on a Tuesday, and the previous game was on Sunday. He had already pitched. There was no way he should have been pitching. But in 14 innings, they went through every single pitcher. He was at a baseball game. He wasn't supposed to pitch. He admitted he had a beer, which we know means he had probably several beers before he went out and was the closer that night. He didn't leave. He didn't go to the showers.
I didn't know that story.
Yeah.
Well, let's close today with a version of Red Light, Green Light, Yellow Light. I'm just going to ask you guys about the Emmy nominations. There's hundreds of people. There's like 500 TV shows, but about 10 shows really dominated the Emmy nominees. I'm just going to ask you if there is a show that you especially liked or a performance that you are especially rooting for. For instance, Parker Posey in White Lotus was one of the best performers and performances to me this past TV season. The Rehearsal, which was one of the most remarkable TV shows I've ever seen, and you might not like it. And episode 3 is the last time I remember laughing that hard at a TV show ever. I could not believe what I was seeing on the screen.
That's with the big puppets, right?
That's with the puppets and stuff like that. It's bizarre. Yep. It's positively bizarre. And so there's my two.
And that was snubbed, John, right? That was the end of that sentence, right?
Well, I did not.
The Rehearsal didn't get a lot of nominations.
It only got 2 for writing and directing. So he got for writing and directing, but the performances or comedy or whatever the hell that was, it's hard to categorize it.
That's insane.
Only 2 nominations.
He did. And big spoiler alert. So pause this if you're going to watch the Rehearsal, and everybody else close their ears. This man learned to fly a 737 jet for television and successfully flew it, and he's not getting a nomination for best actor in a comedy series.
There ought to be an
That's
award for that.
Crazy.
Yeah.
That's also the got most himself. Time I guarantee that anyone's ever put into a role for our television show to do that.
Also
it
got himself
even get a nomination.
All right,
got
that's himself it. On CNN I really didn't as an like expert the show, too. But I'm going to go watch that episode.
What are we doing?
It's
crazy. He got himself on CNN as an aviation expert as well, and that was hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. Wearing a uniform. All right, so that's my TV talk, Eric. What do you want to jump in on here?
I've got 3 performances on TV shows that I really like: Noah Wiley in The Pit, Jeremy Allen White in The Bear, and Hannah Anbinder in Hacks. I thought those were extraordinary performances. And of all the TV shows that got nominated, The Pit, which got 13 nominations, was my biggest green light.
Yeah, ditto here. Yeah. I mean, I could recommend that without reservation. How about you, Brandon? You're doing as much TV as any of us these days.
I think my issue with the Emmys this year is we're acting like only 3 or 4 shows exist. And while I enjoyed White Lotus moderately, I don't think it deserved every single actor being a part of it getting a nomination, especially when a show like Andor, it's a Star Wars show, but man, is it applicable to today's times. It got nominated for best writing in a series, but you don't give anything to the actors who delivered that writing, the biggest snub being Genevieve O'Reilly as Mon Mothma. Everyone expected her to get nominated, and all of a sudden, crickets. We see mostly White Lotus and Severance. I think that's unfair.
I had a national TV critic on today, and I said, of those, what's the best show? He said Andor. He said, you might not watch it, but if you do, you'll be glad you did. I haven't watched a minute of it.
I'll also add one more thing. It's great to see Harrison Ford finally get his Emmy nomination. If you haven't seen Shrinking on Apple TV, I think it's a must watch. It's great slice of life comedy. And he was snubbed last year. But now he finally gets honored for what I think is one of his best roles of his career. So hopefully he wins. The studio had some great nominations too. Maybe too many, but good crop of people for sure.
Kathy Bates at that age getting a nomination was a nice touch. Marge, anything that you especially liked of the performances?
I might have dittoed yours, but I think I would now lead with Gary Oldman in Slow Horses. I think Slow Horses is astounding, and his acting, what's more of a superlative than astounding? I don't know. I'm running out of them. I think he's just amazing. Now, Hacks, I was very disappointed in this last season. I didn't even finish it. And I was a huge fan of that show, but I think it got very repetitive this season and just basically not very funny. But I still think Jean Smart, as an actor, and also Hannah Einbinder, I think they both are terrific. The chemistry they have between them isn't just about the writing. It's about their skill as actors. And I think they deserve the recognition, but Hacks is kind of hacked.
Well, I'm going to be a little bit of a yellow light downer on the sense that Severance and The Bear, much as I love them, I did not think they were especially the best seasons for those shows. My big suggestion was definitely going to be Slow Horses, Marge. Crazy about that show. And I don't think it's gotten a whole lot of recognition. So it's up for both Best Drama Series as well as Gary Oldman being up. And I can't believe Kristen Scott Thomas, though. She's not up. I don't think she is. I'm not seeing her. The other show that's up for Best Drama Series is Paradise, which I feel has flown a little bit under the radar. But everybody in that is amazing. To tell you the truth, I didn't think White Lotus was all that either.
That ran hot the first season, and then everybody maybe is on or off the bus for the second and third. Okay, Kate, thank you. Marge, Brandon, Austin, and Eric, as we record this, I just look out my window, 18 stories up, downtown Chicago. That's a hell of a rainstorm going on outside right now. You all must be feeling that, huh? So stay dry.
I just want to say, by the way, that you know, Brandon's between jobs now, and you can hear from this podcast, we've gotten to know him, that he hits to all fields: politics, culture, sports. And I'm sure that there's going to be some news organization that's going to scoop him up because he's a rare talent in Chicago. And, I think we need to say that we really appreciate having him on and think that things are going to go well. So
you're here. Appreciate that, man.
I second that one.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe.
Hope it's someplace here, too.
Talent like that will find a home. But you hang in there, my friend.
Appreciate it, yo. Thanks.
We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. That's this week's pod. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another edition of the Mincing Rascals on you next week.
All right, y'all.
All right, we filled the room and the time.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, we'll drop it soon. Thanks, kids.
Thanks.
See ya. Thanks, John.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.